From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. If you've always thought you'd be a great stand-up comic, now's your chance. Richard Belzer's drawn on his experiences as one of America's top comics to write his new book, How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. Richard Belzer joins us on this edition of Fresh Air. We also talk with playwright David Henry Wong. His play, M. Butterfly, won this year's Tony Award for Best Play. He collaborated with Philip Glass on a new music theater piece about a woman who believes she was abducted by aliens from outer space. Jazz pianist Dick Hyman is back in our weekly performance spot. Today, he talks about the style and influence of Fats Waller. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the new home video versions of some of Alfred Hitchcock's lesser-known films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me for a return visit to Fresh Air is comic Richard Belzer. As if his field wasn't already crowded enough, he's written a new book called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. It's not guaranteed to land you a spot in your local comedy club, but it will give you a sense of some of the absurdities Belzer has found in the world of comedy. Richard Belzer has appeared on Saturday Night Live, The Tonight Show, and Late Night with David Letterman, and has had his own cable series and specials. At the beginning of his career, he worked as the warm-up comic for Saturday Night Live and was the MC at Catch a Rising Star, one of New York's top comedy clubs. He's appeared in many films. He starred in The Groove Tube and co-stars in the new films Freeway and The Wrong Guys. Richard Belzer, welcome back to Fresh
Air. Thank you. It's great to be here.
I want to go over some of the things you cover in your new book, How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. Now, you give the early warning signs of the stand-up personality.
Yes.
The first is, do you think the death of a relative is funny? So,
right.
Richard Belzer, do you think the death of a relative is funny?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I always found humor in the most tragic things. If you have a child, not you personally, but if anyone out there has a child who does laugh at funerals, that could be one of the early warning signs of a stand-up personality. It doesn't mean that the child is abnormal.
But did that happen to you?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like what?
Like what? What do you mean?
Do you laugh
well,
at a funeral?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What happened to you?
Well, I was asked to leave by one of the elders of the tribe.
Okay, here's another early warning sign of the stand-up personality. Do you enjoy doing impressions of handicapped people?
Uh-huh.
Did you do that when you were young?
Well, that's kind of more of a parody of what some comics do. It's kind of like a left-handed thing about Jerry Lewis.
Now, you did Jerry Lewis impressions when you were very young. I remember in our last interview.
That's right.
You told me that when your mother was beating you, you would sometimes try to distract her with
your impressions
of Jerry Lewis. Now, what appealed to you about him when you were young?
Well, one thing was that I was very frantic and manic when I was a kid. I was always talking, always getting hurt, and always in trouble. Plus, I looked remarkably like Jerry Lewis. I had a crew cut and just physically resembled him, and he was my idol. So I just mimicked him, you know. I probably did a better impression of him then than I do now in my act.
How does your impression of him now compare to the one you did then?
Well, now it's more biting and rough and kind of a put-down, whereas in those days he was my idol. Now that I've grown up, I see through the facade and see him for what he really is.
I mean, a great
performer, but it's just not a question of the thing I do in my act is briefly what I don't like to perform in these contexts. But I say that Jerry Lewis was my idol when I was a kid, but then I recovered. I took Percodan and started doing Dean Martin impressions. And I do a thing about the telephone. I say that Jerry Lewis is on television once a year for 22 hours. I think that's enough, don't you? I mean. And then I go on a little further and get meaner.
In your book, you say the number one rule of comedy, thou shalt not steal. Have you ever had any of your routines stolen by another comic?
Unfortunately, I've seen my material on national television by a famous person who will go unnamed.
Oh, how horrible.
In my early career, I used to MC at Catch a Rising Star in New York, and I went on every night. I used to go on like at 9 to like 2, 3, or 4 in the morning, and I would bring up all the other acts, and I would ran out of material about 5 minutes into it, so I'd have to improvise and, you know, experiment and do a lot of stuff. And I found this out later, but a lot of times comedians would send their writers to Catch to sit in the audience to rip off jokes from unknown comics and do, you know, write the jokes down, do little switches on them, and then sell them to more famous comedians who may not even have heard of the other guy. So it was weird to see something that you did on national television, and then if you did it again, people say, oh, you got that from, you know, that famous person when it was your own bit. That's the worst kind of feeling, Because a joke is a precious thing, and to me it is anyway.
But you're defenseless, right? You can't copyright your jokes.
You can't. There was one case where some, I forget who was involved a few years ago, about 10 years ago or so, where somebody did sue someone about a routine, but I don't recall what the outcome was. It's hard to copyright, because if you change one line, then it's not yours anymore.
You point out in your book that many comics are also super egomaniacs, and that they have an entourage with them, and included in the entourage is the yes man, whose job it is to laugh loudly at all the jokes. Have you seen that, by the way,
successful
friends of yours?
I have.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's one of the saddest things in the world, to see somebody who I knew when, mm-hmm. you know, when they were struggling, and now there's five or six people around them, and every time they do a take, whether it's physical or verbal, two people fall over, another one just looks with this knowing thing, and it's like this mindless idolatry that really dilutes the person's humor, to my way of thinking. I would think, I like people around me who are critical and who are tough as far as an audience is concerned, rather than people who laugh reflexively just because you pay them. It's a big danger. I mean, Elvis could do it because he wasn't a comedian, so, you know, all the guys laughed at his jokes, but he wasn't doing them in Vegas or anything.
You take a couple of swipes at comics who have their catchphrases.
Well, kind of gentle swipes.
Gentle swipes, yeah. Yes. Now, I don't think of you as having any catchphrases, but you always do use the expression babe.
Babe, Sparky, or yeah, sure. I say that a lot. Yeah, sure.
Now, to me, babe, there's like two worlds where babe is used. One is show business and the other is retail.
That's funny. I never thought of it that way. I started using babe. People ask me, where does that come from? When the first time I went to California, I started in New York, my career, and I finally went to L.A. All my friends moved to L.A., and they said, you got to come out here. This is where the business is. And I hated L.A. I mean, I like it now, but in those days, I was allergic to it because I thought New York was the only place to be. And it probably still is, but aside from Philadelphia. But so when I went out there, I realized that this cliche show business thing of babe, everybody did say babe. I mean, agents actually, I thought it was like a Hollywood joke, this babe thing. But I was astounded that people who seemed sincere would say, and I'll see you, babe. And they everything would be babe. And I just thought it was so ludicrous and absurd and so insincere that I just adopted it and just started calling everybody babe and, you know, and using it in different intonations. You know, it could be, you could be, you know, you could scold someone by the way you say babe, or you could, you know, idolize them or dismiss them, or it's an all-purpose word.
Yeah, it works well.
Yeah.
Richard Belzer is my guest, and he's written a new self-help spoof called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. In giving your advice to would-be comics, you tell them about surefire lines for hecklers,
mm-hmm.
and about three of them you could actually repeat on the radio.
Yeah, let's see if I can remember. Well, one that I really like is if somebody in the audience is bothering you, you say, sir or ma'am or whatever, say, I have a microphone, you have a beer, God has a plan, and you're not in on it. You know, that's kind of says it all. But the thing about hecklers is there are different kinds of hecklers. Some hecklers are mean drunks. Some really think they're helping you. Those are the most frustrating, you know. And then there's some that just, you know, want to be a part of the show. And then there are some that are actually very funny, and you have to be, you know, sharper than they are, just as sharp. So it depends on who the heckler is and the context of that show that night.
There are some great photographs of you posed as different kinds of comics,
mm-hmm.
Such as the 1950s jazz bop heroin addict found dead naked in the bathroom look, which
right.
is obviously your little homage to Lenny Bruce. But did you study all those comics when you were growing up, like really watch them and get down their styles and try to be like some of them?
Well, the thing is, when I was a kid, I really felt I was a student of comedy in the true sense of the word. I remember even when I was very young and I watched first on the radio and then later when TV came into existence, I would see a comic on TV and I would say, oh, that's a sight gag, he's getting away easy. Or I knew every little thing that comics did, you know, all the devices and techniques. So by the time I got, you know, to be a full-grown person, I had kind of the storehouse of knowledge in my mind that now, thankfully, I can use.
When you first started performing, were there comics, older comics, who you more or less wanted to overthrow, comics who you thought were either washed up or represented an old school of comedy that you were really tired of?
No. I have a certain reverence for those older guys. To me, I stand on their shoulders, and they may be corny and they may be outdated, but those were the guys that worked when comedy now is a glamorous industry, You know, there are this feature film Punchline's coming out. There are hundreds of nightclubs. Stand-up comedy is becoming a whole renaissance type thing. But, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, there was, you know, a few hundred comedians. Now there's thousands. And there was these guys, you know, you call them Catskill comics, call them whatever you like. They worked, like, every night of the year. They had these great acts that they did. And they were real workhorses. You know, they had their tuxedo and their car, and they went to their jobs. And, you know, and now I'm a member of the Friars Club in New York. And I see some of these people at lunch. And it's great, you know, because when I was a kid, I saw them on TV and listened to them, and now I'm a fellow friar. So.
I remember in Comic Relief on HBO, toward the end of it, it was co-hosted by Billy Crystal.
Right.
And toward the end of it, he said, I remember when we used to make fun of the people who did telethons, and, and here we are realizing how important it is ourselves. But it seems to me that comedy, or at least Billy Crystal, is in the middle of this period of reconciliation with things that they used to make fun of in the world of show business or comedy.
I don't know.
I offer as further proof that he's co-starring with Alan King in a new movie.
Yeah, I know. Alan King, I did a film with Alan King.
Did you?
And he is, between takes, he told the greatest stories. It's amazing.
Uh-huh.
You know, because a lot of times from my generation of people, we're supposed to be really hip and cynical and, you know, the Saturday Night Live groove tube, or that whole anti-establishment. And then you grow up, so to speak, and you meet some of the people who were targets of our satire. And some of them are the sweetest, most talented, wonderful people, as square or strange as they may have seemed to us when we were, you know, doing what they called underground work, you know.
So that doesn't make you feel sorry for having ridiculed them, does it?
No. No. I didn't know any better, or we didn't know any better as a generation.
When you got started, you had a reputation of being a very aggressive, sometimes mean-spirited kind of comic.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do to win that reputation?
Well, as I said before, when I started, I worked in a nightclub called Catch a Rising Star, and I went on every night. And after running out of material, I had to turn towards the audience for material, and I would say, where you're from, or I'd say something about what they're wearing, or what do you do. And my style evolved out of dealing with drunken people at, you know, 12, 1, 2 in the morning, and trying to make be like an alchemist and get the lead out of their lives and turn it into gold and golden jokes. So I think part of my reputation stems from those days of when I was just very acerbic and cynical and improvising off of people in the audience.
It was more than that, though, too, wasn't it?
Well, like what?
Oh, like the kinds of things you'd include in your routines.
Oh, yeah. Well, some of the routines were how should I say? But I don't think my material has changed in attitude as that much. I mean, I hear in the last couple of years that I've mellowed. I don't think I've mellowed on stage. I may be off stage. I'm more accessible, more diplomatic, and easier to talk to, but on stage, I think I'm just as vehement and cynical as I ever was, maybe even more so.
I've interviewed several women comics lately who all have the same complaint to make, which is that at the comedy clubs, that there are so many men doing this really sexist, misogynist material. And I wonder if you noticed that, too?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's despicable. And I think that one of the shameful aspects of stand-up comedy is that it's been male-dominated for so long, and there has been misogyny and chauvinism involved. And I really admire and respect most of the women now who are in it, because years ago, for a woman to do stand-up, she had to put herself down and had to, you know, like Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers were doing, how ugly their husbands were, how ugly they were. And that, even when I was younger and not in the business, for some reason, that kind of stuff just didn't sit right with me. Now there's a lot of very bright, intelligent women doing stand-up, so it's like a whole new world. It's very refreshing because there's so many of them.
How do you draw the line between okay and tasteless, or between tasteless and offensive? I think that's the thing. Like, if you're doing a joke about women, a joke about gays, a joke about blacks or Asians,
right?
If you're going to include material like that in your repertoire, how do you decide for yourself if it's just like okay, tasteless, or if it is truly
homophobic,
yeah, I know exactly. What's the difference between like a good joke about a black person and a really racist joke, or a good joke about, you know, your wife or your lover, and a joke that is like really misogynist?
That's a very good question. It's really an ethical problem for each comedian to decide for themselves. I mean, I do jokes about AIDS, but I I'm certain that it's not a homophobic joke.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I'll tell you the joke.
Okay.
Well, it's not really a joke. It's true. I'm terrified of AIDS. I have AIDS hysteria. When I have sex now, I wear a condom, I wear gloves, I wear a surgical mask, and that's when I'm by myself. To give you an idea how terrified I am of that particular malady. So, but I see a lot of that, unfortunately, and you know, I rarely do this, but there's this one comic, I won't name the person. He does this really vicious, homophobic thing about AIDS, and it's almost like he's some Old Testament, you know, psychotic, you know, saying "see" and you know, and just blaming people for the disease, you know, just the worst kind of thing. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, why are you so vicious about this particular thing? And he said, because it gets laughs. And that to me is, you know, is so it's such a mindless response. I mean, there are a lot of things you could do on stage to get a laugh, but I have this thing about quality laughs, vacuous laughs, meaningless laughs. I mean, there are comedians who go up and kill the audience. And I don't even smile once. And then there are others who, you know, well, it's in everything in between. But it's. I think it's a personal ethical thing that, I know it sounds funny to talk about ethics and stand-up, but some of us have those.
Do you think that your standards have changed over the years?
My standards?
Standards in terms of when a joke is truly sexist or racist and what it's
absolutely.
Just, you know,
I think I'm much more sensitive to certain things, particularly, you know, homosexuality and women. I can't cite examples, but I just know from how I've evolved as a person that I'm sure I'm more cognizant of people's feelings, even though I've been called, you know, rough and ready to hurt anybody. But
I've seen you do something very funny to, like, say something to someone in the audience who's wearing a yarmulke, and then say, well, it's okay for Jews to make fun of other Jews. And then you kind of clutch your heart as if God is striking you dead for saying it.
Yes.
but is it okay, do you think, is there a special liberty you have of making fun of people who are in your sexual or racial or ethnic group?
Again, I've seen people of particular persuasions, whether it's gender or race or religion, do jokes about the thing that they are, and they're just as racist or homophobic. You know, I mean, there's this one black comedian who does these terrible jokes about eating chicken and big butts, and, you know, and it's like, where is this guy coming from? I mean, it really. And then there are people who aren't of that persuasion who are much more sensitive and do jokes about, you know, blacks or gays that are funny and insightful and not that way. So it's a strange thing. I think sometimes people get mugged into acting out the stereotype they think the culture wants them to be. And that's very dangerous, I think.
Well, we're going to talk more. But first, we have to take a short break. My guest is comic Richard Belzer. And he's written a new book called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. And we're after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Comic Richard Belzer is my guest, author of the new book, How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. He's also co-starring in the new film, Freeway. You know, we were talking about standards of tastelessness in humor. and you say in your new book that the thing that you can never, never make fun of is Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
I was wondering how much truth was in that.
Well, people ask me, are there any sacred cows in show business? I mean, in stand-up comedy. And there is only one, and that's the chairman of the board, Francis Albert Sinatra. And I have advice in my book, if a comedian's on stage and for some reason a joke slips out about Frank Sinatra, you're immediately supposed to say, just kidding, Frank, and then take a beat and repeat it again, just kidding, Frank. Otherwise, you'd be doing your act through a respirator and not a microphone.
Does it really come and get you if you say something, or you're just making that up?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
Well, I mean, he has this reputation of, you know, beating people up and, you know, being, I don't want to get in trouble, but I think you know what I mean.
Right. Okay. We've talked a little bit about how you've changed. One obvious way that you've changed, you dress really differently than you used to when you were starting out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're starting out, you had, like, long, stringy hair.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Beetle. And, Jay Leno used to say, Belzer, where'd you get the beetle wig?
And now, I mean, you know, you have, you know, nicely styled hair, as I think what it's called, and like, really nice clothes. And I wonder what changed in you to
money.
Bring about that? Was that what it was?
Money and having TV shows where you could steal the wardrobe. Kind of the two things. Plus, my wife has good taste. So between those three things, stealing a wardrobe, having money, having a wife with taste.
Another thing that changed, and tell me if you mind me bringing that up, from what I've read about you, you used to do drugs and so on.
Well, like other members of my generation,
yeah, right,
in the 1960s,
right.
I did, in fact, imbibe, as many of my peers did.
Yeah. No, the impression I got was that you were hanging out with Belushi and stuff when he was really in trouble, and that had changed you a lot. His death had changed you a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was... I don't want to talk about it.
That's fine.
Okay,
moving right along. We're talking about insulting things to say about other people. What about self-deprecation? Will you really bring out vulnerable spots about yourself in a routine?
Will I? Actually, some of them I do, much to my own remarkable revelation. Yeah, so I occasionally do a bit about my childhood, where my brother and I used to play, and we used to play Scary House, where we would... And this is true. We would take our bedroom, which we shared in those days, and one of us would go out of the room, and the other one would stay in the room and turn the room into a haunted house. And then the other kid would come in, and the other one would try to scare him. And what happened would, I'd come in the room. It's funny because when you go in the hall and wait, and you say, okay, come in, and you open the door, the light from the hall reveals everything in the room anyway, so it's, I mean, what's so scary? I mean, you know the two beds, you know the dead turtles on the radiator, and you know the cowboys are on the wallpaper, and you know the linoleum's on the floor, so. But my brother did this one thing once. I came in the room, and he rolled a toy truck across the floor, so all you heard was the little wheels squeaking, and he said, it's very scary in here, there's monsters in here, you might even get in your bed, and there might be a sharp object, and you might even get cut, and a monster's going to wet your bed, and you're going to be blamed for it, and there's sharp objects in it, you know, just, and we used to play these games, and it's, you know, that's about as vulnerable as I get, I guess.
Okay. You've said that humor is sometimes about things that really scare you.
Mm-hmm.
What are things that really scare you?
Well, I mean, the culture, I mean, all of us, like the Challenger accident, AIDS, and there are things mm-hmm. that are going on that are incomprehensibly frightening. And I think that we reflexively make jokes about these things because we're afraid of them, not because we're mean.
What scares you politically right now?
Everything. This is the most terrifying. The last 8 years have been, for me personally, and I hope for other thinking, feeling human beings, a really bad, sad time for America. I think the Reagan administration has systematically disassembled some of the great things about this country and the government in terms of helping the disenfranchised and in terms of students, old people, farmers, blacks have been totally written off. The military, as you know, is armed to the teeth with things that don't work. I mean, it's really, all the nightmares about Reagan are true, and I think it's starting to come out a little bit now, but he'll leave office, and I predict the next president will be a one-term president because it's going to be such a mess that they're inheriting that everything will fall on his shoulders. So in a way, that's why Mario Cuomo didn't run for president. Because he's too smart, and it would have been a step down to run, I think, and Bradley and Sam Nunn and people like that. But this is the first election, I think, where people don't want anybody to win. It's like nobody likes Bush, nobody likes Dukakis, and, you know, we were tired of Reagan, and it's like we're in limbo. There's a lot of uncertainty in the air.
Have you had to learn to do convincing caricatures of Bush and Dukakis?
Well, Mommy told me not to make fun of George, but George Bush, first of all, his name is really ripe for the press. If he's president, the headlines will be, Bush was trimmed today. You know, Bush went out on a limb today. Bush was burning, but it wasn't God's voice coming out. And this whole thing about not being a wimp and revealing every little... The thing that amazes me about this election is that each side is telling what they're doing to change their candidate to make them more accessible to the voter. I mean, if the person isn't accessible to begin with, now they're, you know, in a fake way trying to change them. I mean, it's an absurd situation that we're in because there's no more secrets. People are very media-wise, you know, the electorate. And I feel that no one's going to vote this time.
But can you do Bush and Dukakis? Do you
George
need to?
Bush, well, George Bush, I'm not a wimp. I am working on Dukakis. He's very hard to do.
Why is he hard to do?
It's just one of those voices that is oppressively ordinary and has like one tone to it. and there's no ups or downs, there's no inflection, there's no intonation. It's at least Bush has this whiny kind of thing that sounds a little bit like, you know, Liberace had a child with Jack Nicholson. You know, you could figure out. Most characters are conglomerations of other characters, but Dukakis doesn't sound like or remind me of anybody. I mean, he looks like Rod Serling. You know, he sounds a little bit like Joe Franklin, you know. But he's got one eyebrow and, you know, he's 3'11", so I don't know.
You do a lot of rock performers. You do Springsteen and Jagger and, mm-hmm. and Bob Dylan. Is it a fantasy of yours to be a rock star yourself?
Absolutely. When about 10 years ago, I had a radio show in New York.
Right.
And I had a little money. So I got a band. And when I did my concerts, you know, I did stand-up, but I also had the band. So I'd do Dylan and I'd do Springsteen and I'd do Jagger and I did all my singing impressions. It was great. It cost me a fortune, but it was fun. I think a lot of comedians are frustrated rock stars. And every rock star I know wants to be funny, so there's got to be a trade-off somewhere.
Maybe there's something science can work out.
Yeah, right.
some kind of crossbreeding. So have you ever done any of your impressions of rock stars with them in the audience?
Yes. On November 19th, 1979, at the Bottom Line in New York City,
Glad you remember that.
Yeah. I was on stage, and I used to close my act with my Jagger impression. And I came off stage, and the owner of the club came back and said, "Guess who's in the audience?" And I said, "Who?" He said, "Mick Jagger, and he wants to meet you." And he was very funny, and he was great. And a similar story happened. I used to do this bit about Roman Polanski renting Jack Nicholson's house, and then Nicholson has to go to court to testify about it. And I did that bit at the Roxy in L.A., and Nicholson was in the audience. And somebody came up and said, "Guess who's here?" And I said, "Oh, no," and I was afraid. But I figured if he's the Jack that we all know and love, and he didn't think it's funny, then I'm not going to like him. And he came up, and he had a big grin on his face, and he said, "I closed my eyes, and I thought it was me. You did a good job."
Oh, so I can never figure out, maybe it's because I'm so bad at it myself, how someone can really get the voice of somebody else. Does it come to you, or do you work at it hard?
It's interesting. Some voices I can do immediately upon hearing them, and others I have to really work on. Some are just I could never do, and some are easier than others. Like Nixon, for instance, I didn't want to. A lot of impressionists do an impression of another impressionist's impression, because some people it's easier for them to define the voice when they hear the exaggeration that someone else picked out. But with Nixon, I didn't want to do David Frye's impression because he did a brilliant one that was recognizable. And so I got a tape of a speech by Nixon, and I listened to it every day. I'd go for walks, and I'd listen and listen, and I'd try and I'd try, and I finally got his voice from him as opposed to David Frye. But I must admit there are other voices that I've gotten by listening to other people's impressions. I mean, I don't do their material, but there's something about the voice that sometimes other people can define that you can't, and it's helpful.
Do you think of yourself as having a very distinctive voice?
I've been told that I do. I'll take that compliment.
Okay. Well, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been comic Richard Belzer, and you've probably seen him on David Letterman and Johnny Carson, Saturday Night Live. He's written a new book called How to Be a Stand-Up Comic, and it's just been published by Villard Books. Villard Books, thank you for the correction.
Division of Random House.
Okay. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, a live jazz concert with singer Sheila Jordan and bassist Harvey Swartz. And they'll do some standards, probably some original songs as well. I hope you can join us.
Oh, God's children got rhythm. Oh, God's children got swing. Ain't got money, ain't got shoes. We got rhythm, chase away the blues. Oh, God's children got troubles. Troubles don't mean a thing. When we start to swing, troubles fade away. All God's children got bebop. When I spoke to you the day, my heart began to stray to you, my love, and so I swayed with you, my love, and as we danced, my heart began to do a number. Wonder why I'd be so.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The 1988 Tony Award for Best Play went to David Wong for M. Butterfly, about a French diplomat who has an affair with a Chinese woman who's really a man and a spy. Coming up, Wong reads from M. Butterfly, and we talk about his new music theater piece, a collaboration with Philip Glass. Also, jazz pianist Dick Hyman joins us once more, this time to talk about and to play the music of Fats Waller. And Ken Tucker reviews some of Alfred Hitchcock's lesser-known films now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A federal judge today gave former Deputy White House Chief of Staff Michael Deaver a suspended 3-year jail sentence. Deaver was also ordered to pay a $100,000 fine for lying about lobbying former White House colleagues on behalf of wealthy clients. Deaver could have faced up to 15 years in prison. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson said that although Deaver had deliberately told lies to the grand jury and the Congress, there would be no purpose in sending him to jail. Deaver, in tears, embraced his lawyers. His wife choked back a sob and then rushed to the front of the courtroom to hug her husband. In a statement in court and then again outside, Deaver blamed his troubles on alcoholism and said he would appeal his conviction.
I think it was a very fair sentence if I'd been guilty.
President Reagan, on hearing of the sentence, said he continues to believe in Deaver's innocence. Said the president, "I still believe he didn't do anything wrong." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A 5-officer court-martial today convicted a Navy rescue swimming instructor of negligent homicide in the drowning of a 19-year-old airman recruit. Petty Officer Second Class Michael Combe was also found guilty of conspiracy to commit battery. The court-martial rejected the more serious charge of involuntary manslaughter. Combe was found guilty of repeatedly dunking Lee Marecki in a swimming pool at Pensacola Naval Air Station while other students were ordered to face away and sing the national anthem. Combe could also be sentenced to up to a year in prison on the negligent homicide charge compared to 3 years for manslaughter. The Dutch ambassador to Burma today said brutality in the capital city of Rangoon has reached a level where even Red Cross volunteers have been shot by soldiers since the army took power last Sunday. The United States has issued a formal protest to Burma's new military rulers over an incident last night in which Burmese troops demanded admission to a U.S. embassy warehouse while holding guns to the heads of U.S. guards. Reportedly, the soldiers were not admitted. In Washington today, the State Department announced the evacuation of 5 American diplomats from Rangoon, and spokesman Charles Redmond said U.S. assistance to Burma is being shut off.
In light of the current unsettled political conditions, we are unable to continue our assistance programs for the time being. We look forward to renewing cooperation with Burma and the Burmese people when conditions permit a resumption.
More American diplomats are expected to be pulled out of Burma this weekend. The State Department today is denying charges by Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega that it has blocked visa requests which would allow Nicaraguan diplomats to attend the United Nations General Assembly. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega had canceled his scheduled trip this month to the United Nations in protest of what he called the State Department's denial of visas for his delegation. But State Department spokesman Charles Redmond blamed the Nicaraguans for applying late. Redmond says an understaffed embassy in Managua needed 15 working days to process Nicaraguan visa applications and that Sandinista officials made their request on September 13th for a September 24th arrival in New York. Redmond added that Ortega and 29 other members of his delegation had received their visas.
We still are processing 37 additional members of the delegation, and we're going to continue to process those applications unless the Nicaraguans formally withdraw them.
Nicaraguan diplomats in Washington and New York deny their government was late in requesting the visas and complained that the controversy interferes with Ortega's plans to address the Organization of American States in Washington on September 29th. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street today, stocks finished higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up more than 10 points to finish the week at 2090.68. Advances slightly outnumbered declines in trading of 145 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 6 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Dick Hyman is our performer in residence this month. Today he's chosen to play some songs by one of the most original pianists and composers in jazz, Fats Waller.
When I was a kid, I was surrounded by shelves and shelves of 78 RPM records, which my big brother collected, jazz classics. And this was a time before they were all reissued on LP. But among those records, there was a large quantity of those of Fats Waller. Fats Waller was a pianist, an entertainer, a singer, a very funny guy. In fact, much of the public thought of him more as a comic, or at least an amusing entertainer, than as a great jazz pianist. Ironically, Louis Armstrong shared the same fate, and much of the public remembers him more for his wonderful stage personality than for the fact that he was one of the great innovators of jazz trumpet playing. To get back to Fats Waller, before he became that sort of public persona, was a pianist and an organist in the kind of 1920s theaters where they showed silent films with organ accompaniment. And in the 1920s, he recorded a lot of piano solos in pure stride style. That is to say, the left hand walks back and forth like this. That's a stride bass. Without telling you what it is, that's what it sounds like. Then the right hand does this kind of thing. Well, Fats was a master of this. He was the protege of the man who many pianists call the granddaddy of stride piano, and that was James P. Johnson. But in some ways, Fats, the pupil, could do it even better than James P., the teacher. I'd like to play a piece that Fats recorded in the 1920s before he had his own band and before he became the entertainer for which, as I said, he became noted later on. I don't know why it's called this. It's called Valentine Stomp. Was it recorded on Valentine Day? Was it something to do with the Valentine Day massacre in Chicago around that time? Who knows? This is Valentine Stomp. There's a lot more to the Fats Waller effect. which I, for obvious reasons, I won't get into, and that has to do with the inimitable way that Fats sang, with a kind of a growl and a huskiness and a playfulness, and very often a kind of a mocking attitude toward the occasionally banal songs that the record companies gave him to perform. He was a considerable piano player by any standards, and a considerable songwriter, too, and this is probably his best-known piece, Ain't Misbehavin'.
Next week, Dick Hyman plays the music of Teddy Wilson. This is Fresh Air. Playwright David Henry Wong won the 1988 Tony Award for his play M. Butterfly, the story of a French diplomat who falls in love with a Chinese opera star who's a spy posing as a woman. In his earlier plays, Wong directly addressed the Asian American experience. His recent plays are less autobiographical, but they raise questions about ethnic stereotypes and alienation from the mainstream. Wong's latest work, A Thousand Airplanes on the Roof, is a music theater collaboration with composer Philip Glass and designer Jerome Serlin. It features one character who believes she's been abducted by aliens and taken into the fifth dimension. But when she returns home, she's afraid to tell anyone because she knows they'll think she's crazy.
Poor backward cousins who... No, no, no. Galileo died years ago. But humans, in our arrogance, still think the universe revolves around us. It is better to forget. It is pointless to remember. No one will believe you. You will have spoken a heresy. You will be outcast.
I think that there's, a lot of interest right now in the line between science fiction and science fact. And so it seemed extremely timely and interesting to explore. And the more we read the actual literature about people who have believed they've gone through these experiences, the more we were kind of moved by their situation.
What were some of the common themes that you found that you wanted to use in your text in reading the literature about people who had sighted UFOs?
What I found most moving about the whole experience was that it seemed to me that these people were put in an insoluble dilemma, that to the extent that they admitted that this thing had happened to them, they were by definition crazy. But to the extent they pretended that it didn't, it created a disjunction in themselves about denying something they believed to be true and consequently made them crazy. And so that dilemma is at the psychological crux of the text that I composed.
What about that dilemma spoke to you personally? Had you experienced a similar dilemma yourself?
I think that all of us are, you know, while not that many of us may actually believe we've been taken up by UFOs, I think we've all had the experience at some point of having a feeling something that we can't communicate to other people and therefore believing that we may be crazy. In retrospect, if I go into it, it may have something to do with this whole feeling of alienation relating to some of my earlier work about, you know, Chinese Americans and feeling an outsider in this society and trying to adjust to the society. It seems to me that there is some sort of psychological parallel there.
Your play M. Butterfly won the 1988 Tony Award for Best Play. It was about a French diplomat whose fantasy is fulfilled while he's stationed in China. He has a mistress who is his idea of the perfect woman. She is submissive, vulnerable, and beautiful. But this woman turns out to really be a man who's actually a spy and is betraying this French diplomat. This was based on a true story. When you read the newspaper article about this case of an American diplomat who was betrayed by a man posing as a woman, what made you realize that you could get the kind of resonance out of it that you did on themes like racism, sexism?
When I first read the article, the actual diplomat, whose name is Bernard Borisko, it was a very short article, it was just two paragraphs, but he was trying to account for the fact that he had never seen his lover naked. And he said, well, I thought she was very modest. I thought it must have been a Chinese custom. And I knew immediately that it's not a Chinese custom, that Asian women are not any more shy with their lovers than are women of the West. But I did also realize that it conforms to a certain Western stereotype of what the submissive Oriental woman would be. I therefore concluded that this French diplomat had fallen in love with not an actual person, but a fantasy of the Orient. And I also inferred from that that the spy, to the extent he allowed the diplomat to persist in this misperception, was manipulating that whole stereotype. And so that kind of gave me the psychological crux to begin thinking about the play and how it could have been possible.
I would really love it if you would just read a little bit of the text that you wrote for M. Butterfly. And I think this will give us some idea of how you use this story to get at issues of sexism and racism.
Okay. Well, I'm going to read just a little section from the scene where the Frenchman, Gallimard, and the Chinese spy, Sung, first meet. And he meets her at the German ambassador's house and has just seen her perform the death scene for Madame Butterfly. Gallimard says, I usually don't like Butterfly. Sung, I can't blame you in the least. Gallimard, I mean the story. Sung, ridiculous. Gallimard, I like the story, but... What? Sung says, it's one of your favorite fantasies, isn't it? The submissive Oriental woman and the cruel white man? Gallimard, well, I didn't quite mean... Sung, consider it this way. What would you say if a blonde homecoming queen fell in love with a short Japanese businessman? He treats her cruelly, then goes home for 3 years, during which time she prays to his picture and turns down marriage from a young Kennedy. Then, when she learns he has remarried, she kills herself. Now, I believe you would consider this girl to be a deranged idiot, correct? But because it's an Oriental who kills herself for a Westerner, you find it beautiful. Gallimard, yes, well, I see your point. Sung, I will never do Butterfly again, Monsieur Gallimard. If you wish to see some real theater, come to the Peking Opera sometime. Expand your mind.
Well, you know, later on, Sung points out in your play that in the Peking Opera, women's roles are performed by men because only a man knows how a woman is supposed to act.
Right, and later on in the play, actually, Gallimard says, I'm a man who loved a woman created by a man. So I think the notion is that this whole idea of the perfect woman is false, even to the point of the woman actually being a man.
And that the perfect woman is just purely a projection of male
right.
fantasy. This is something women have to contend with all the time, and mm-hmm. I think women think about these kinds of issues a lot. You're a man thinking about these issues, and I was wondering what sensitized you to this idea of the perfect woman being a male fantasy.
Well, I think that, you know, as a man, I'm conscious of the degree to which those sort of sexist elements play in my own psyche. I mean, that when I'm attracted to a woman or something, there are good reasons to be attracted and bad reasons to be attracted. And I think that as a man, I'm conscious of that many times my reasons are not so good. But I think also as an Asian and being aware of a certain amount of discrimination or condescension or patronization or something from society at large gives me a certain means of identifying with the way perhaps women are patronized in this society.
Your parents are both Chinese. Mm-hmm. Your father was from China. Your mother, I think, grew up in the Philippines.
Right.
You grew up in the States.
Right.
Was assimilation an issue in your family?
I think that assimilation was assumed in my family because we're a bit odd in that the normal pattern among immigrants is that the immigrant generation sticks very close to the old country and then the next generation has to rebel. In my family, the immigrant generation assimilated extremely quickly. And consequently, my sort of retrograde interest in the things of Asia is something that normally in your standard sociological pattern would happen to my children. So that we were just assumed that we were assimilated from the moment I was born, I think.
I think, though, in the United States, frequently, no matter how assimilated you may feel, if you look like an Asian, you are assumed to be Asian, and mm-hmm. you are not, in other people's eyes,
right.
American.
Well, see, that's the disjunction. At some point, if you believe that you're assimilated, then on some level, if your belief is not that complex, what you're essentially believing is that you're white. And at some point, you realize that you're not, and therefore this creates this disjunction. And that's kind of the, I think, identity crisis that a lot of people of color face.
What has been the most shocking thing for you, seeing one of your plays actually performed? Seeing it realized by a really good actor or actress?
I think that when I see something performed of mine performed really well, the thing that surprises me is that I don't hear the gears turning in my own head. When it's not performed so well, I'm very aware of, you know, I'm doing this as a writer, I'm doing that as a writer. But when I can sort of be absorbed into it and watch it as an audience member, almost as if I hadn't written it, and it seems to me almost fresh, that's the most sort of amazing and really joyful thing.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Wong's new music theater piece, 1,000 Airplanes on the Roof, was given its American premiere September 22nd at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. It runs through October 2nd before touring to 38 cities. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead and see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, President Reagan's close advisor and longtime friend Michael Deaver was sentenced today. He was sentenced to a 3-year suspended sentence and also fined $100,000 for lying about lobbying for big companies after leaving the White House, and we'll have a report on that.
Are you going to give us a preview of Sunday night's presidential debate?
Yes, we will. Linda Wertheimer and Jim Angle, who have been covering the campaigns, will talk both about the campaigns, how they've been going, and what might be expected on Sunday. Some observers say that the debate is crucial, and especially for Michael Dukakis. We also ask a couple of political observers for tips for the candidates on how they might perform come this Sunday.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you've already rented videos of Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest and Vertigo 25 times each and yearn for more from the master, you're in luck. Some of his most underrated films have just been released on home video. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of his favorite, Shadow of a Doubt.
In Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, made in 1943, a psycho killer comes to a small California town to visit his favorite niece and her family. No one knows that this uncle is a murderous nutcase because he's played by Joseph Cotten as a sweet, thoughtful, quiet man. His teenage niece Charlie, played by Teresa Wright, has always adored her uncle. It takes most of the length of Shadow of a Doubt for her to admit to herself that the man she reveres is actually strangling women right and left. As in the best Hitchcock films, this unbelievable premise is carried out with serene logic and leads to a tense climax as Joseph Cotten delivers this malevolent little speech to a wide-eyed Teresa Wright in a local bar.
You're just an ordinary little girl living in an ordinary little town. You wake up every morning of your life and you know perfectly well that there's nothing in the world to trouble you. You go through your ordinary little day, and at night you sleep your untroubled, ordinary little sleep filled with peaceful, stupid dreams. and I brought you nightmares. Or did I, or was it a silly, inexpert little lie? You live in a dream. You're a sleepwalker, blind. How do you know what the world is like? Do you know the world is a foul sty?
Shadow of a Doubt was based on a screenplay co-authored by Thornton Wilder, whose contributions undoubtedly included the details of sleepy small-town life. With this film, Hitchcock took Wilder's Our Town and turned it into Alienation Town, as a young woman's trust in her most beloved relative is cruelly betrayed. Though it wasn't a particularly big commercial hit, Hitchcock himself said that Shadow of a Doubt was his favorite among his films. There are a number of other lesser-known but worthy Hitchcock films recently released on cassette. The best of these are I Confess, starring Montgomery Clift as a conflicted priest, The Wrong Man with Henry Fonda as a man accused of a crime he didn't commit, and Rope, a murder mystery starring James Stewart that was filmed in one room with one camera. It's mostly just a cinematic stunt, but it's an entertaining one. Oh yes, there's also Under Capricorn, Hitchcock's only attempt at a costume drama period piece, and it's a real stinker. Other new video cassette releases include a pair of uneven new comedies. Hairspray is director John Waters' spoof of 60s dance crazes, but it will probably remain best known as the movie in which Divine gave his last performance as the mother of the film's teenage hero. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles stars Steve Martin and John Candy as an odd couple on the road. They're strangers who are thrown together during a doomed trip from New York to Chicago. The way John Hughes directed it, the movie is much too bland, but early on, the friction between Steve Martin and John Candy is fascinating to watch, since these excellent comic actors are working in such wildly different styles.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's some music from Mel Brooks' homage to Hitchcock, High Anxiety. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with writer Harold Brodkey. Critics have compared him to Faulkner and Proust, partly for the quality of his prose, but also for the 30 years of work that have gone into his still unfinished novel. Excerpts from that work are included in his new collection titled Stories in an Almost Classical Mode. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead surveys the career of veteran bassist Milt Hinton and reviews a newly published collection of Hinton's candid photographs of fellow jazz musicians, including Billie Holiday, Cab Calloway, and John Coltrane. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the first debate of the presidential campaign. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.